You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is our KBOO Fights Back campaign. KBOO knows the importance of community media when we need it most. Help us reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. Join KBOO Community Radio for an in-person meet and greet at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Stop by KBOO on Saturday, December 6th or Sunday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Meet radio hosts and producers, members of the board of directors, and fellow KBOO community members. Enjoy coffee or tea and light refreshments, take a tour of the station, and make your year-end donation in person. For more information about KBOO Fights Back in-person events, visit kboo.fm/in-person2025. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
There's something missing in the litting. I got something to say. Oh, yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
You're listening to another segment of Transpositive PDX. My name is Emma.
My name is Sheila.
So Sheila, what's been going on? What do you want to talk about today?
Well, I heard from Gene that there was a resolution in Congress or a petition signed by all the Democrats, or most of them, and then a few Republicans, that abusive language towards the trans community should not be allowed in the chamber. I haven't had time to research it yet, but if that's so, I'm very pleased to hear that.
Yeah, that was about Sarah McBride. That was, I mean, the only transgender person we have, and Sarah McBride actually helped to lead that push, you know, to get Nancy Mace and other Congress people to stop calling her sir and to stop referring to her as a man. So that's good. I mean, Sarah McBride hasn't made being transgender like her issue. I mean, she's a congresswoman and she's representing the whole state of Delaware, and she's made it really clear that, like, you know, her first priority is the people of Delaware. So she's kind of, she stepped back a little bit on, you know, just being like, oh, I'm the transgender person, and so I'm going to talk about this all the time. And she's just kind of being a congressperson, which she's gotten some criticism from. She's gotten some criticism from Aaron Reed around that, another trans activist who want her to be, you know, the leading national figure for the transgender rights movement. But on this particular issue, I think this is a really good you know, good match for her, because yes, of course she should be treated with respect in the U.S. House of Representatives. I mean, regardless of whether you agree with somebody's pronouns or not, you can still call them ma'am anyways. It doesn't hurt you anything to call them ma'am, madam, you know, madam representative, and to give them the courtesies that, to give her the courtesies that she deserves to have as a duly elected representative. What do you think, mm-hmm. Sheila?
It's a matter of dishonoring a chamber when people are spoken of in a way that is meant to be deliberately offensive. They would claim that they are operating out of a resistance to an invalid ideology. But I attended a class today on neurodivergence, not to say that gender dysphoria is necessarily a formal example of that, but it does show that people have experiences that are very different from, in many ways, whether it's from dyslexia or from things that were not so much researched or talked about when I was growing up. But the fact of the matter is they do exist, and trans feelings do exist. And the fact that a political versus a medical model has been put forward by the opposition, to me, shows a characteristic of an ideology. Whenever you don't want to accept an actual fact of human behavior, it's by its very reason that you are opposing that, it shows that you have a closed mind, and usually a mind that's drawing its basis from something other than the facts. And that's when you're dealing with an ideology. When you're dealing with something that's recognized by various medical associations, by definition, you're dealing with science, and therefore, to that degree, you're dealing with objectivity. And the problem that I see, and that has always been present for our community, is we're a group of people looking for a metaphor for our experience. And we don't think about this enough, but that's what makes life go round, is how we choose to categorize things means that we say it's similar to this and dissimilar to that. And so for the trans community, in the early days, we were looking for medical recognition, not that we wanted to be pathologized in any way, but we wanted to at least get it forward that this was not something we'd cooked up out of our own little minds, and that we were then foisting upon an unsuspecting public, but that this was actually a verifiable condition, even if a rare condition. And there's all kinds of conditions like that. If anyone that picks up a medical textbook can find syndromes and things out there of all manner of types, and yet we don't say that they're an ideology, and we don't say that they're an imaginary thing. But if it touches sex, then suddenly it becomes an ideology. And there's a problem with that. So one of the things I hoped we could talk about tonight is How do we as a people survive? And it is not as though the transgender community is the only targeted community. I could argue very much that the entire middle class of America is the target right now of a minority mindset that makes life very hard for people, whether it's jockeying their rent up to an incredible degree so that they simply cannot afford to retain their apartment, whether it's firing them at will and then plunging us into a recession, which it looks like that may be happening. There's so much more in play right now than just trans people, but we share those same needs with other people. We need housing. We need respect. We need safety on the streets. We do not need to be assaulted or deserve to be assaulted in any way. And we do not need to be disrespected or made to feel bad about ourselves. And so one of the things I'm hoping we can talk about tonight is how do we create community solidarity so that we can support each other and find common ground with other people who are feeling victimized? Because one of the things that you'll notice in history is whenever you're oppressed in any way by any group, the tendency is to want to direct that anger not to the people that are causing this harm, but to fellow sufferers. And this is why anything that unifies people, whether it's a union, there's a great movie a few years ago called Matewan about the coal mines. And one of the characters, they're trying to organize against the oppression of the coal companies. And one of the union organizers says, "You look at this man who is applied to be a member of the union, and you see him as a black man. I see a brother union member. And until you learn to see it that way, you're not a union." And that's what I think we need to do. We need to find as much support from people that are similarly suffering as we possibly can find. And we start with our gay and lesbian sisters, and then we move on from there. But we try to not direct our resentment or our frustrations at other people who are also suffering. And I sometimes think if you could get people that are part of the MAGA movement together with people like us, they would find that they have far more in common than they have in divergence and keeping them apart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Yeah, great comment. You know, I mean, I think that What we're really seeing right now in this moment is that transgender people are really facing just these incredible economic pressures right now. And I think that that touches on a lot of what you were commenting on. I mean, the economic pressures that transgender people are facing are forcing us to make some really hard choices. You know, I mean, we're losing access to healthcare. The healthcare that we can afford is getting super expensive. And yet, you know, we still persist. I mean, we persist. Housing has gotten more expensive, and it hasn't been any easier for transgender people to get a job. I mean, it's legal now in more places to discriminate against us than it was a few years ago. I mean, several states have passed laws specifically decriminalizing discrimination against transgender people. I mean, and as a result, a lot of people are fleeing. They're coming to Oregon. They're moving to Canada. They're getting in their cars and they're moving to places where they'll have a little more opportunity. But, you know, the problem is that we have this rogue government, this rogue administration that doesn't care about the Constitution and doesn't care about constitutional process, doesn't care about established norms, is willing to completely violate the law in order to try to accomplish some of the things they're doing. And this administration needs to be reined in. I mean, it's out of control, and it's illegal, it's immoral, it's corrupt, and it's un-American. So those are my thoughts.
Well, I remember some of the early cases of transgender discrimination, and some companies actually went to the extent of saying that you could come wearing a sweater, but you couldn't wear a skirt, and you couldn't wear pearls around your neck. In other words, they were so worried about a gender marker that even something that seems as inanimate as a pearl necklace would be seen as being something that would be, you would be walking across some no man's land, like in a World War One movie, hopping out of your trench and climbing over the barbed wire to cross over to this other gender. And I thought, if gender is as natural as they say it is, then all the pearl necklaces in the world shouldn't make any difference. But so why were they threatened by that? And it's, again, it's because to some extent we live in a symbolic universe. Pronouns are an example of that. Pronouns are simply a linguistic means that we use to express something. But the idea of being addressed by your preferred pronouns is a matter of courtesy and affirmation. And so it's always seemed to me that the goal of the opposition is to say, by making it hard to live, or by refusing to recognize your evaluation of yourself, it isn't so much that they feel that you're going to slip them a counterfeit bill or that you're going to go to bed with the wrong sex. That isn't even it. It goes much deeper than that. It's the recognition of the transgender phenomenon as being an actual part of human experience. It's to make it invisible, and by making it invisible, make it impossible for people to transition psychologically. And so I think, well, what other areas do we use social disapprobation to mold behavior? How do we train people? When I was growing up, good citizenship meant courtesy. We weren't even dealing with questions of name calling. The idea of a president of the United States that would actually use derogatory words for a governor of a state and turn Governor Newsom into Governor Newscum would have been so drawn out of what an elementary school kid would do that you would be laughed out of office by acting like that. So what's happened recently is we've normalized derogatory discourse. And the reason that we've done that is because the goal is to divide people from each other, to insult them. If we think about violence, it's the same way. Why is it that spousal abuse, for instance, always begins with calling a woman horrible names, making her feel bad, making her feel that her body is in some way something that can be attacked first verbally and only secondarily physically? Why does that happen? And the answer is because it's an effort at control. And the people that feel that need for control are people who are fearful people. A guy like our president manifests that fear, and the more he fails to live up to the realities of his own embodiment, the fact that he is walking with a limp, that there's he's somewhat showing signs of being bloated with fluid. Why is it that he posts images of himself as a sort of a DC Comics superhero when anybody could simply look at him and see a man who's been on a horrible diet for years, is grossly overweight, and who nobody in the world would ever want to see in a normal bathing suit? So why does he feel he has to do that? Because he has internalized shame. And people with internalized shame like to export that shame onto other people. So our survival is not only a struggle for political rights, it's also a struggle for economic rights. But above all, it's a struggle for self-respect, so that when that stuff comes at us, we don't internalize it. Because when we start to internalize their hatred, that's when we start harming ourselves. Our first loyalty as a community is to honor ourselves and honor other people, and not to fall into the same habit of mind and expression that is so inappropriate in a civilized society, let alone in governmental circles. So that's why what we started with tonight was saying the legislature is recognizing that freedom of debate in the houses does not mean the freedom to be gratuitously insulting of other people, especially a legislator sent to the Congress by the people of their state.
One of the things that you were commenting on, Sheila, that I was thinking about from an earlier conversation this week was the irony of the situation where this goes back to what you were talking about just a minute ago, where the President of the United States on No King's Day tweeted out an image of him relieving himself, you know, doing number two on a bunch of on protesters, like a giant figure. Now, this was an obscene image, and I can't use the language that I would normally use to discuss something that the president has sent out, because it's literally against FCC rules to say the act that the president himself was tweeting out. But mm-hmm. this is, you know, talking about the president of the United States and about uh-huh. something that he put out on his official channels. You know, so the president sent out an image that was obscene, and that you can't actually use the proper words to describe what he did because it was obscene and it violates FCC rules, even though these are rules that, like, you know, the president has violated. I mean, the president has violated these rules in his tweets. And you can't describe it because you might get in trouble with the government for describing something that the president did. I mean, that's like just uber, that's like way out there. And it's not the only thing that the president has done recently. Recently, the president called mm-hmm. for the execution of Democratic leaders who were telling soldiers to disobey illegal orders. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing that is treasonous about telling military personnel to disobey illegal orders, such as the order to come to Portland and to, you know, violate the law by having National Guards people under the control of federal jurisdiction who are assigned to a state governor. So the governor is the proper authority for that. And but in spite of that, the state is being overrun by the federal government against the express will of the governor, against the express will of the citizens of the state, and to no purpose. So, I mean, but we could see this from the beginning of this administration, because at the very beginning of this administration, what this administration did was it started by promoting fake science. You know, the idea that mm-hmm. transgender people aren't real, and that biological essentialism is the only thing that's real, you know, against established medical opinion, against broad social consensus for gender variance. You know, this administration and its highly conservative agenda, which, you know, I mean, if you ask me, I would say that most of the legislation that this administration is pushing, most of the executive orders that this administration has put out, have probably been written by people within the Heritage Foundation. I mean, I think that you have a government basically being run by a right-wing political think tank. I mean, I think that the Heritage Foundation is really shaping this narrative, and you can see how very, very extreme they are, and how incredibly out of touch they are with Americans. And all they're doing is they're pursuing this idea that they have the legitimate use of power because they have won a small, very, very slim majority of the votes in the last election, that somehow that gives them the right to violate all established political norms, to violate the Constitution, and to engage in reckless illegal activities, which I'm sure are going to be the subject of Truth and Reconciliation commissions in the future, and will be the subject of endless historical discussions about where the United States like made a wrong turn and veered away from democracy.
Well, let's just unpack this example of the threat that certain people who have advocated and called attention to members of the services, the armed services, to say, you do not have to obey an illegal order. Let's just turn that around and say it the way it apparently the president was asking it be construed, which would be, if you're a member of the armed services and you receive an illegal order, therefore one completely beyond the power of the presidency to give, that you should still obey it. And then if you disobey it, you are committing a sedition against the government, and people advocating that, even in opinion, not actually doing it themselves because they're not members of the service, are somehow seditious by simply expressing that opinion. You see how far it is from any kind of legitimate thing. But if you pack it the way they do it, it shows the underlying assumption of executive power, which is that anything Donald Trump says, by definition, is not illegal because he said it. Now, the Supreme Court did say that when exercising a core governmental function, the president can't be prosecuted for doing something wrong, but that has no effect whatsoever on the soldiers that would be getting the order. They are not granted that similar immunity. So for a legislature to warn them and say, please bear in mind that if you're given an order, let's just take an example. Let's say to clear the ground for the president to walk from the White House to the church and hold up his Bible. Let's say the president has said, if anybody gets in your way, you can shoot them dead on the spot. And I'm giving you permission. In fact, I'll go one step further. I'm ordering you to shoot them dead on the spot. Would anybody believe that that order should be obeyed? Answer, no. So for them to be guilty of sedition by reminding soldiers that we do not live in a world of Napoleon where something can be ordered and therefore there is no way to oppose that, it was simply calling them to obey the military laws that we have in place for armed troops about what they can and can't do. Now, granted, it's a pretty brave thing to say, and you're standing online and have received a direct order from a superior officer that you can break the order you've been given. But let's take this example of shooting an unarmed person dead on the spot because your officer told you to do it, and he did it because the president ordered him to do it. Would anybody think that there should be no repercussions for that? And the answer is, of course not. But it's threatening to President Trump's concept of what he deserves because he's never quite understood that his presidential powers are not absolute. We are a limited constitutional government, and that means there are certain things that not even the president can do. But it's very alarming to have somebody with their finger on the nuclear trigger believing that he cannot be called into question by anybody. I would hate to say if he carried that own philosophy into his own discretionary thing and say, if I just decide apropos because I've had a bad day that I'm going to simply nuke half of Europe or half of Russia, if he says something like that, that everybody should naturally obey him. I don't know that we've adopted the national policy of saying no first strike, but I like to think that our anti-nuclear treaties through the years have said that we're not going to be the one to initiate an atomic war. But it's a sad thing about this. If something opened the door to that, I don't know who would stop him. I really don't. So it shows a very dangerous mindset for your chief executive to act like he does on a daily basis. And when you look at the arbitrary firings of essential personnel in our executive branch, we're all suffering from these things. So the thing that I'm worried about is if the general populace is having problems with losing jobs, losing housing, losing food, maybe being up against a recession, I can only imagine it's going to hit our community pretty hard. So I hoped tonight we could explore a little bit about ways that we could find to get ourselves through a tough period, if a tough period is just over the horizon waiting for us. How do we take care of our housing? How do we take care of our jobs? How do we make sure that we're fed? And how do we make sure that we don't have to back clear up into denial of our existence simply as the price of survival?
Wow, those are some great points, Sheila. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
I think we're getting kind of near the end of this segment of the show. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Well, a couple of thoughts. I recall that in times of the past, people did a certain amount of couch surfing. And sometimes if people didn't qualify for housing, they learned how to have roommates. And it's also valuable to learn what immigrant communities have done, because they are a group even more targeted than we are. I think it's important to read up a little bit on survival literature. I mean, how did Anne Frank make it through the Second World War when they were living? I've actually been in Anne Frank's little, it was called the Secret Annex. It was behind a bookshelf in a house in Amsterdam. And she lived with her family up there in total silence and had to be smuggled up little beans and things, lived on a diet of cold beans for years. And people do heroic things in times like these. So the biggest thing, I don't want people to give up. I don't want them to get discouraged. And I want them to look back at our own things that we've had to go through, whether it was dealing with the AIDS crisis, whether it was dealing with civil rights as at Stonewall. It's like so important that we not lose track of what people do to survive through hard times, and not to feel isolated and alone, but to find common cause with other people similarly situated.
Well, there you go. You've been listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio with Emma and
Sheila.
And thanks so much for joining us. And now on to the next segment of the show.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. Tonight we'll be discussing the public response to the recent Charlie Kirk assassination and how it's affecting the trans community. So let's introduce ourselves real quick. I'm Nicolette and I use they, them pronouns.
My name is Emma and I use she, her pronouns.
I'm Sheila and I guess tonight I'll use they pronouns as in they ain't nobody here but us chickens.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. So for a bit of background, on September 10th, right-wing political activist Charlie Kirk was publicly shot and killed by Tyler Robinson, a white cishet man who was also a right-wing activist, and killed Kirk because he believed Kirk wasn't far right enough. Now, initially, an early internal law enforcement bulletin claimed that ammunition recovered following the shooting was engraved with transgender ideology. It turned out this was because the bullet cases had the initials TRN stamped on them, which is the mark of the Turkish bullet manufacturer Turan. But officials apparently saw TRN and thought trans, even though that had nothing to do with that. Rumors already began to quickly spread that Kirk was shot by a trans person, and mainstream news sources published false info, making people believe the shooter was undoubtedly trans. Right-wingers then began identifying, doxing, and threatening trans people. On September 11th, right-wing influencer Joey Manarino tweeted, quote, "If the person who killed Charlie Kirk was a transgender, there can be no mercy for that species any longer. We've already tolerated far too much from these creatures," end quote. Now, if you listen to our previous shows about the ongoing transgenocide, you know that one of the 10 steps to the genocide is painting a targeted group as animals, vermin, or something other than human in order to eventually justify killing them. This post from Manarino directly refers to trans people as an inhuman species and implies that we deserve violence. Manarino then continued to call for trans people to be rounded up, detained, and studied because of our, quote, propensity for mass murder. Transphobes have since been mass reporting trans people to the FBI, and the amount of death threats, doxing, bullying, and violence trans people have experienced has ruined lives and forced people into hiding. And even after, you know, the information about who Tyler Robinson really was and that he wasn't trans began to spread, I've also seen people spreading the rumor that Tyler had a trans girlfriend, which is also not true. But people are just, like, transphobes are just looking for any possible way to blame trans people for this shooting, especially after trans people were just recently blamed for another shooting that happened fairly recently, which we, with that background, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I've got so many thoughts, but I'd like to ask Sheila if she'd like to go first.
Now, the thing that's disturbing is that the very first narrative of the president, President Trump, was to say, we're going to track down all the people that are involved in this, implying that this was not a solitary act by a solitary shooter, but that it was part of a conspiracy or that someone had put him up to this. And another narrative that has gone out has been that the Democratic Party somehow is financing these terrorist networks, of which this is only just one further example. So the thing that's very disturbing is, without any data whatsoever, already there were assumptions being made. They're beginning to take two instances, and now an associate, someone that was living with, that had no idea any more than the parents did that this was ever going to happen. And now they're assuming that transgender people do this every day, and therefore it's okay to go after trans people and see us as a threat. And the thing that worries me is when I see all these ICE raids and I see whole lines of people in civilian dress that are being arrested and basically taken off the streets and taken God knows where, it's not paranoid for us to begin to imagine that as the country gets used to watching these arrests happening on the street, that maybe something will affect us and some of us will be arrested in just this kind of way and spirited away to God knows where.
So I'd like to say a couple of things. Here's what I have to say about this. The shooting was really horrible. There's no doubt about it. It was horrible. I mean, it was, and the fact that it was tweeted right away. And so lots of people had a chance to see it. And this, you know, the person who was murdered was not treated with any dignity. I mean, it was a terrible, horrible, brutal thing. And it was just like watching a lynching or a public execution. And nobody should have to see that. That's a horrible thing to see. And no matter what you think about anyone, that's just a brutal, terrible thing to do to anyone. But during times like this, people often take their grief and they turn it into, they're trying to find somebody to blame. And when that blame becomes a weapon, when there are twists in the tools of blame and division, We lose something essential. We lose our humanity. The recent shooting is a devastating reminder of how fragile life is and how quickly violence can shatter our illusion of safety. But what followed in the wake of that tragedy was not healing. It was a campaign of scapegoating, an attempt to tie the actions of one individual to an entire community simply because the shooter lived with a transgender partner. This is not justice. This is not truth. This is fear masquerading as righteousness. Transgender people are not a threat. We are not a political ideology. We are not a monolith. We are individuals, each one of us with our own story, with our own dreams, and statistically, we are much more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. According to the Williams Institute, transgender people are 4 times more likely to experience violence than cisgender people. That is the truth. It's the reality that we must confront. And yet, in the aftermath of this shooting, we saw headlines that rushed to link the violence to our community. We have seen public figures and media outlets amplify these claims. These claims, some of them were later walked back, but the damage was done and the narrative was seeded. And once it takes root, it spreads. The hatred spreads, just like in the Bible, in the angel of death, in the story from the Exodus. It's just like that. And these kinds of ugly rumors and these terrible, vicious lies and the slandering and the way that we have become this disparaged group, it spreads like the angel of death. We must resist the urge to simplify complex tragedies into convenient scapegoats. We must resist the temptation to turn grief into blame. And we must resist the voices, however loud or powerful, that tell us to fear those of us who are different. There's nothing to fear about transgender people. We're your neighbors. We're your friends. We're your customers. Sometimes we're the people riding on the bus with you. Sometimes we're even your relatives. And there's nothing to be afraid of about us. I believe in compassion. I believe in truth, and I believe in the power of art to reflect the world not as it is, but as it could be. I believe that every person, regardless of their gender identity, deserves to live without the fear of violence, without the fear of being vilified for simply existing. To those of us who are transgender or questioning or trying to live authentically, I see you. I honor your courage. And I reject the narrative that paints our community as dangerous. We do not paint with fear. We paint with light. We paint with color, with the full spectrum of the human experience, the colors of the rainbow. So let's mourn the loss of life without losing our moral compass. Let's seek justice without sacrificing truth. And let us remember that the measure of a society is not how it treats the powerful, but how it treats the vulnerable. This is not just about one shooting. It's about the kind of world we want to live in. And I, for one, choose a world where empathy triumphs over fear.
Thank you, Emma. That was beautiful. And I appreciate you putting your positive spin or take, I guess, on all of this, when I think a lot of us are feeling a lot of fear and anger right now in response to all of this. You know, I keep bringing up the genocide because I just keep seeing more and more of the steps being enacted. And I think that it's just going to continue unless we find a way to put a stop to it now. Because, like I said, they like transphobes are seeking any possible way to connect us with anything bad. It's like any tragedy, any bad thing that happens, they find some way to blame trans people for it, even if we had nothing to do with it. And I think it's just they're trying to round up all the justification they can to eventually wipe us out or try to wipe us out, because it has nothing to do with any of the things they're trying to blame us for. It's just we are different and they don't like that. That's all it comes down to. They just want to get rid of everyone who's different from them.
I'm a strong believer in the principles of nonviolence. I mean, I don't own a weapon. I don't engage in violence with other people who threaten me. And I believe that in situations like this, these are moments when nonviolence is really needed more than ever. I mean, nonviolence is a guiding principle of my life. And right now, I'm choosing to practice nonviolent resistance. I mean, but part of what not being nonviolent means is it means you have to look into the face of your oppressor and you have to imagine yourself in their shoes. And when you look at your oppressor and you imagine yourself in their shoes, then you have to try to have empathy for that person. And by doing that, by having empathy for the person that you would normally see as your enemy, you're able to understand how you and your enemy share the same earth. You breathe the same air. You stand under the same sunlight. And when you begin to see your enemy not as your enemy, but as another fellow human being who is as equally deserving of compassion and empathy as you are for yourself, it gives you a space in which to step into relationship with your enemy. It's very unique and it's very powerful and it's transforming. And by stepping into relationship with your enemy, you actually transform your enemy. You transform the person who hates you and who wants to do you harm, because they come to see that you are the same as them, because you're modeling empathy, you're modeling compassion, you know, and you're modeling another way. It's really powerful what you do with nonviolence, because you open this entire door to somebody's heart, and not just to their heart, but to their intellect too, because we're so accustomed to seeing the world through the lens of violence and through the lens of retribution and reaction. And when you step into a relationship with something nonviolently, you're giving your enemy an opportunity to see a completely different world. It's like getting to see a rainbow or getting to see the world in color. And it's a really powerful experience. So I'm really trying to be nonviolent in this moment.
I appreciate that, you know, and I really appreciate your viewpoint on it. I can see where you're coming from. I just also want to look at it from the perspective of, we may need to accept that we are dealing possibly with enemies who have no empathy, and we should probably prepare for what to do in that scenario, if that is true. Because I mean, like Charlie Kirk himself said that he believed empathy was a bad thing. We're talking about his supporters, and you know, his supporters believe that empathy is a bad thing. So as much as, you know, modeling empathy may be very helpful when, you know, when facing our enemies, and some people may take very well to that, I feel like we should also prepare for the inevitability of dealing with people who have no empathy, have no interest in empathy, and view it as a bad thing. How do we defend ourselves from them? That's just the question I would like to pose.
Yes. I think that what we have to do is look at what is our response individually and then what is our response communally. Individually, in any time of heightened tension, when something captures the airwaves, particularly when death is involved, there's likely to be somebody seeking retribution. There's a lot of people that fit the psychological profile of the shooter and on both sides of the political divide. And it's very possible that some of us should be on heightened guard to make sure that if we're walking in the street, if we're going out to bars late at night, anything that we're going to do, we're going to have to be a little bit more aware than we normally are. That's just common sense in times of heightened tension. The thing that's a little more disturbing is that there could be some real hangover from this, so that the heightened tension may last longer than this particular news cycle. The images of informed in the public's consciousness based on these false narratives of transgender menace is simply not true. But once it's in somebody's head, it can last for a long time. So maybe it'll be good to keep a heightened guard and awareness. Make sure people know where you are. Make sure if anything ever happens, you're going to just disappear. Make sure there's people that know where you were going. And I think this is a good individual response. A good communal response is to realize that Trump's regime is throwing the widest possible lasso they can, including accusing the entire Democratic Party of being honeycombed by radical, quote, radical leftists. So in other words, communists, socialists, people that are, quote, woke or, quote, follow transgender ideology. And I've always said that being transgender is largely a matter of fighting for the privilege to be self-defining. And if it looks like we're doing it solely ourselves, then we're seen as being not having a right to literally embody gender expression according to something that we feel deeply inside, and also have a great deal of with the pain, which is called gender dysphoria, which is involved in some of the lack of expression when gender behaviors are mandated according to an arbitrarily assigned set of social signifiers that say you can't wear ladies' clothes, you can't wear makeup, and you can't behave in a feminine fashion, because it usually comes down hardest on people moving from an assigned male position to a female position. And when that happens, in the old days, it was just a matter of ridicule or calling you a sissy or something. Now we have the added disadvantage of being not only victims, but now we are designated predators, that somehow or other we are the ones that are going out and getting beaten up and killed, which of course is not, we're not doing this. It's happening to our community. And the proof is that we have to have a transgender day of remembrance every November to account for the people that were murdered or beaten up or damaged in some way simply by virtue of being trans. And the other thing is that many are forced into adopting sex work, not that there aren't sometimes other alternatives, but the reason is because as a group, we are collectively, our economic status in society is not very good. And when you're dealing with prejudice, a lot of people don't want to hire us because we're perceived as being someone that people will be uncomfortable around and therefore will cost the employer business. And so it took for one of the things I remember from the old days was when the Americans with Disabilities Act came out, there was an amendment from the, I believe, the House floor that said, notwithstanding any appearance that this is a mental disorder, these groups of people are selectively chosen as being people that cannot claim any benefits under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they included the following groups: kleptomaniacs, pyromaniacs, and people that were manifesting divergent genders. Well, so the image left in the public's mind is if we weren't shoplifting, we were setting fires all over the place. And other than that, it just being cross-gender identified was itself seen as being something unworthy of being seen as a lasting defect. So no matter which way we played that side of the net, we were going to lose. Either we were fully capable people that were faking it by pretending to be cross-gender, and therefore we were victims of an ideology, or we had a mental disease, but one that was not sufficient, even though it met all the other criteria for inclusion under the Americans with Disabilities Act because of its permanence and because of certain other factors that would have triggered their protections, but we weren't allowed to do it because we were literally line item vetoed in the very bill. So here was this forward-looking bill that was deformed at the last minute by an amendment from the House, which was designed, of course, to make sure, and I think it was Jesse Helms that did it. I think it was, but you'd have to look it up on Wikipedia to be sure. It's been a while. But, and I don't know if that's been amended since then, but it was on its face. It was literally embodied discrimination in a very forward-looking type of legislation, which in itself, it was an insult to the entire bill because it was included as though it was an integral part of the bill rather than a deformation of the bill. And that's what we're still up against. So we're battling all the time for definitions. And right now we are being selectively defined as malefactors, toting guns, and likely to be the next person that's going to go out and shoot somebody up. And it's just not true. This is seemingly an entirely white young male prototype of the alienated school shooters and other shooters that have a grudge and sometimes a very global grudge against society and are looking for their hour in the sun.
Yeah. I want to speak to something that Nicolette brought up a few minutes ago, and that was my experience as a transgender person has taught me that beauty is not found in sameness. It's found in complexity. Transgender people are part of the beauty of the world. Our existence is not a political statement. It is a human truth, and no amount of fear-mongering can erase that. I know that some people are worried about being harmed physically, emotionally, spiritually. I know that walking through the world as a transgender person can feel like an act of defiance. But it's also an act of hope. There are many people who see us, who value us, and who will stand between us and the storm. I am one of these people. I will not be silent while others try to paint us as dangerous. I will not stand by while our identity is twisted as a scapegoat for someone else's violence. I will not let fear win. Instead, I will speak up as I am right now. I will write, and I will show up. I will remind the world that transgender people are not a threat. We are a gift. A reminder that identity is not fixed. Truth is not always visible, and courage often looks like simply existing. If you feel afraid, please know your fear is valid, but it is not the whole story. There is the strength in you. There is community. There is love. And there are people like me who will walk beside you, who will speak your name with reverence, and will fight for your right to live and freely be safe. You are not alone. You are not alone. You are not alone. Let those words be a balm. Let them be a promise. Let them be a beginning.
All right. Thank you for joining us tonight, everyone. Thank you for listening. Stay strong out there and stay safe. You've been listening to Transpositive. Have a good night, and we'll see you next time. One.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, KBOO. At KBOO, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KBOO want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KBOO supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.